This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're on remote. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and with us is Jawan Choi, and she's going to give us an opening poem.
Thank you, Grace. I'm going to read Back to 1951. My father is forgetting my face as he lies dying in the company of parrots, in bright eyeshadow and lips like Christmas, on a battery of wings surrounded by a halo of flies. He is lifted back to 1951, 17, and hiding in the mountains, living off bitter roots and small snakes, giving the Red Army the finger. He stayed there long after soldiers went back to their farm and factory lives, while I tried to fit inside his tin can of a heart. Thou shalt not smoke. Thou shalt not skip breakfast. Thou shalt not end up an old maid. Did Confucius say headstrong daughters must assume the venerable position? Do it anyway, kowtow and contemplate remains of flesh and bone melting into silt and soil.
The voice of Jawan Choi. And that is from what book?
This is from the first poetry book titled One Daughter is Worth 10 Sons.
Yes. And I want to say something about your titles, which I really like a lot. The most recent book is called I Used to Be Korean. Now, what do you think a reader would expect to find in that book by that title?
It was definitely a very tongue-in-cheek title, and I was initially going to use it as a placeholder more than anything. But the more I thought about it, I thought it really did fit what I was thinking about at the time. So there will be, I think, some cheeky poems in there, maybe a little irritated, but hopefully, trying to connect to others who also maybe feel the same way, you know, about their heritage.
I do think the titles give us a sense of a very sparkling, saucy, energetic poet. And they're just slant enough to pique our interest, and we're never disappointed. So that was a narrative poem. And you have many different styles in your books. Let's hear a poem with a different take.
I definitely have a sensibility in terms of my childhood. So the next one that I'm going to read is inspired by the blackout in 1977 in New York City. This is called 1977, Kitty Land, The Devil, and My Dorothy Hamill Bangs. One, the Ferris wheel and carousel used to draw them in. Now it's down to the clown in a dress and the midget fire eater to gather the reluctant into a crowd, swindle them into watching the grotesque pageantry that is the state of our humanity. Pennies tossed into a cup. Two, the city is burning through a thousand fires. West 107th Street goes black while I sit under the table, listening to how menacing empty spaces can be. My father's whispers turn into hissing. It's the devil. Talking through him, slithering into my ear, my brain, and my only escape is to slip into the hole inside my head. Three, on TV, zombies are clutching new sneakers and heaving mattresses over shoulders, not so interested in my human flesh. They look like they are shopping, except you know they are stealing because they are smiling and not paying for any of it. Four, in the morning, I look to see if I am a zombie. and find my Dorothy Hamill bangs unharmed, and my face is not rotten meat. My father is in the kitchen with his head in our hot refrigerator. He pulls out the peanut butter and says, get the bread.
Wow. Do you start with an intention or do you start with a handful of words that arrange themselves in a stanza, which is adapting itself to your feelings at the time? How do your poems get to look on the page the way you feel?
I like to just start writing just to see what the words will look like on the page. But I do have a sense of a lot of images in my head that I wonder how I can interpret these images onto a page, which is what I admire about many, you know, poets who probably have sort of a painterly process. So definitely images, I think, are a good place to start for me. But also, I think it just depends on what's inspiring me at the time. Yes. I'm inspired a lot by music, by other writers, and of course, you know, experiences of my childhood.
Right. And I think that emotionally, when there is a tension, the lines tend to be shorter in your work. If there's a very compressed feeling, I notice that it's more vertical. So it's really interesting. Your aesthetic shows your feelings on the page. The Dorothy Hamill bangs make me laugh because it's a popular icon that is like a historical bookmark. But explain who Dorothy Hamill was.
Well, she was and still is a very famous ice skater. I remember seeing her on TV, and she always had this great sort of hairstyle with the bangs. And I never actually got to see her, you know, perform or anything like that, but we definitely watched her a lot on television.
Did you have Dorothy Hamill bangs?
I did have some bangs when I was younger.
Okay. Let us get a more and more and more of Jiwon Choi with two poems in a row. Let's do that. See what happens.
Okay, two poems in a row. Let's see. Can I do sort of another longish one?
Yeah, what is the title?
I was thinking, How Will I Know I Was Alive? And I wrote this for Philip Levine.
Yes, let's hear that one.
Okay. How Will I Know I Was Alive for Philip Levine? One, lay me sloth under a pile of leaves, free from the desire to deconstruct Rumi or the perfect banana cream pie, until genetic forces and the Big Bang conspire to make me what I am, morbid, dreaming in blood of broken bodies and ghosts fully formed. Two, my flesh, your flesh, our nature is animal. What is human? Sad rhetoric and theories leading to assassinations in Texas, napalm in Cambodia. Look what they did to Lumumba in Congo. God made me with a hole in my heart, but you say it was evolution. Three, they dig up bones all the time under shopping malls and car parks. Mandible, femur, ulna, pieces of the puzzle, when butterflies slumbered in amber and men were made of mountains. The story about the time traveler who falls up a hole in the street is true. He falls in love with the librarian who finds him staring at neon signs. She takes him home for a tuna sandwich. Four, when I was eight, I walked the bottom of some guy's pool at a party on Long Island, looking for that trick door into Atlantis, where I would live out my mermaid's tale in a fortress of kelp and coral, trapping wide-eyed sailors for my kettle, burying conquistadors and digging up Blackbeard's gold. The topless thing might be awkward, but so is watching the Lawrence Welk show every Saturday night with my father. 5. I don't want to be a memory floating up into the sky. What was it all for?
You have some beautiful lines. First of all, why is that after Philip Levine or for Philip Levine? How is that poem addressed to him? I was wondering if you studied with him.
Oh, I've never met Philip Levine, but
you like his work?
I do read a lot of his work. I learned from him just by reading his work. Mm-hmm. And I think he writes just for regular people like mm-hmm. me. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what I really take away from his spirit. I had listened to your interview with him when he became the Poet Laureate. And I was I thought that was one of the most inspiring things that I'd heard in a while.
Thank you for that. He was very ill during that time and we did not know it. And yet he shines. And you know, wouldn't it be wonderful if he knew that even today he was inspiring poets like you? That's the thing about ancestry, and you will be doing that for younger poets in years to come. That's the wonderful thing about our trade. What are the last two lines of that poem again? The last three lines.
The last three lines. I don't want to be a memory floating up into the sky. What was it all for?
Love it. Love it. Love your last lines. You have some beautiful lines. One which captured me in another poem was, what can time take that you have already let go? Does that mean that you've finally released your childhood or thoughts that were not of service to you?
I wrote that poem for my aunt because she passed away last July, but she was in the hospital a lot. And I wrote that poem when I was in the hospital with her.
It's a great line. It's a great line. What can time take that you have already let go?
Because she was letting go.
Yeah, but that means a million other things. A million other things. Juwan Choi is our guest. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We are at the Library of Congress while on remote. And Juwan is going to continue with her poetry as we look at it and hear it.
So I'll read a short poem called Cinnamon Toast from the second book. I used to be Korean. Cinnamon Toast. Buttering those thin slices to the brink of destruction, bedazzling with sugar and cinnamon, shellacking fingers and teeth, our lubricated lips kissing in your white kitchen before your mother gets home, while our grammar homework gets cold.
So there you start with an anecdote and then it becomes a poem. How does an anecdote become a poem?
I think that poetry is everything, and poetry. I find there's a symbiotic relationship between our existence and poetry. And I think that what I love so much about writing poetry is that really you can find magic in whatever is maybe mundane, you know, whatever seems very, you know, sort of flat or gray is actually full of color. And I think that's really the gift of poetry and our work really as poets to reveal that.
Our gift.
Everyone.
Our gift to ourselves also. Let's follow that up with Rockaway Diary, because that also begins and ends in the kitchen.
Oh, that's so interesting. That's the next one that I was going to read after Cinnamon Toast, because I think they kind of bookend each other nicely. Mm-hmm. Rockaway Diary, 1986. Your father in heaven, Bela Lugosi incarnate, all forehead, leering around corners, lingering under the stairway. His penchant for culverts puts him in the order of miscreant. Mother coffee teeth, clutching her once white mug, right on cue, 6 a.m., she begins her search for the milk. Will she remember to look behind the pickles and Sunny D? Olivia's boyfriend, goatee, almost 30. He's known her since she was 8. Takes notice now that she's a head taller than him. No one is appalled. Your pa's dead and ma's on the couch again. Sandbar. I like to tell how we were nearly lost at sea, forgetting that Poseidon must not be trusted. He will catch you up in his folds of bleak water, and the shape-shifting sand meant to fool us into thinking it's land, but no, it's not. On the lifeguard chair, your wild heart crashing into me like the sea. I am drowning in your Irish promise. Wild thistle. You grow where naught can, cracking through rock to reach the sun. When did you become the craggy old man, pushing to the counter to order your coffee and 2 eggs on a roll?
Can we talk about the father in literature? We do that a lot on this program. And it is mostly male poets who are so obsessed with their fathers. But you and I, in our own work, refer to our fathers quite a bit. And many women do. Don't you believe, in a way, he was your muse? Because without him, you wouldn't have a lot of poems.
I guess I didn't realize how much I loved my father until he passed away in 2006. And I wish I had understood my love for him. And I guess that's why I write about him so much. But yes, he is definitely one of my muses, as is my mother.
Yes, I agree. And there is something about forgiving ourselves that happens when we write the poem, I think, because it's always an homage to him, even if he's just drinking a can of beer or what, or smelling like tobacco or whatever. It is still an homage. You're bringing to life someone who is being made permanent. That's quite a thing to do.
Right. I mean, he had a hard life, and we had a hard life as immigrants, poor. You know, it's everyone's story, right? Our story is nothing more special than anyone else's, but
it's your story. No one knows your story. That's why your poetry is inimitable. That's why we cannot do without your poetry, or you would come and go and we wouldn't know you. So I beg everyone to tell their story. Some do it better than others. You do it really well. And let's hear more of your story.
Well, thank you for saying that. I appreciate it.
Juwan Choi.
This is a poem that I wrote for my mother. You live in the space behind your eyes. Look at this universe you've built for old school friends and your favorite Shakespeare teacher. Your father smelling of tobacco and beer is here too, and the cousin who died in childbirth. You picnic here, forage wild greens, gather fallen chestnuts, and bite into all the persimmons, never minding the juice running down your chin. So what I have always known is true. You were a mother made up entirely of memories. Sorrowful membrane, combative DNA, regretful ribosomes, and the truth of it at a quarter tilt is that your primordial bacteria structure is coming undone, to be swallowed by your bleak house of loose nails and sagging walls.
Juwan Choi works with children. What do you do with these children?
I'm a preschool teacher at a community-based organization on the Lower East Side. We work with senior citizens and teens and young children as well. But I primarily work with four-year-olds as a classroom teacher.
What is a four-year-old like?
They're wonderful. They are, they're very brave, they're passionate, they're compassionate, and they're very loving. And they're interested in everything, in each other. And so we make sure that we are providing a really supportive learning space for the children and their families. And we were in, during the pandemic, we were still open this year, the school year. So I saw my kids nearly every day.
How many do you have, and are you, do you have the same children every day?
Yes, we had 14 this year. Normally we would have 18, but we did a smaller classroom size. And yes, they come Monday through Friday, or if they want to come less, you know, that's, they just organize that with the school if they don't want to come all day, you know, 5 days.
Is it an all day program?
Yeah, it is. We go from 8:30 and the kids leave at 3. So it's a full day.
Mm-hmm. Do they inspire you? Because the way children put words together is absolutely fabulous. Do you get some ideas from the way they articulate?
I think I really appreciate their spirit. And I think that we have to remember that we are all still those four-year-olds ourselves in many ways. We are not, even though we might be older, we are still that child. Like the bridge, you know, the bridge is still down. We go back and forth being like four and back to this age. So I think their spirit really inspires me to be honest more than anything.
You know, that's a good way. That's a good way to put it. The bridge goes up and down for sure. So I think we could learn a lot from them. They're really still unruined, right?
I mean, I think a lot of these children have seen so much, really, and there's and depending on your family life, I don't know how much you're protected from struggle. I think a lot of families, if they're struggling, their kids are going to see it. But if they come to school and they spend time with us, at least they know that they have a space at school that's consistent, that is going to support them. Because I think young children really do suffer, you know, because they don't really have a lot of power. And, you know, not every family lets us know the hardships that they have at home. So
your kindness helps. Your kindness helps. And let us go on with another poem.
This poem, because I, for some reason, love, and as everyone does, The Sound of Music, I wrote it while thinking about my father, but also The Sound of Music, called Ready. Watching Julie Andrews choose Christopher Plummer over God is dramatic. I know her struggle is real because she is singing about it. It is the right choice, of course. What kind of life could she have with God? No going to movies. Forget cruises to the Antilles and get used to all those quiet nights reading. It is during the scene when captain and novice find each other that my mother calls to tell me my father has died in his sleep after a month of moaning through hospital halls as their resident ghost. He was ready. I know this mantra is the best she can muster, and we non-believers have nothing better to offer. No operatives in the wide blue yonder. Wherever he is, I hope my father is climbing every mountain.
Dynamite, dynamite ending. Wonderful ending. Let's have one more.
And this one is called Montgomery Clift, because he is such a wonderful actor. And I read a great bio by him years ago by Patty Bosworth, which is really worth reading. Montgomery Clift. If Montgomery Clift had been Korean, we could have married. Oh. We would have met on set. Me practicing my American accent, and Monty checking out the key grip or best boy, depending on his appetite that day. Oh, yes. He would admit that he was only half my type, but half is better than nothing. We'd have coffee and donuts and discuss inclinations and playlists. Oh, yes, please. Our Malibu love nest would be perfect for mixing martinis and guests. I'd Deborah Kerr my hair into tense waves, and Monty would make like Burt Lancaster and smolder on top of the duvet. Oh, yay.
I'm still laughing. Jawan Joy is the author of these two books, One Daughter is Worth 10 Sons, and I Used to Be Korean, and the titles tell you how smart and saucy and funny she can be, how funny, sad she can make us. Now we will have a final poem.
I'm going to end with a new poem inspired by the album Sonny Stitt Plays Bird. Sonny Stitt Plays Bird. Sonny Stitt plays Now's the Time, and you believe you can fly. Believe you have discovered the magic flute to propel you, cut through the tightened seal of time and space. You can transverse the complications of your diminution here. What your imagination will not allow, your body memory will take hold, so that you may realize you were of wings after all, riding the north wind across these hemispheres, making the seasons Guadalajara, Lima, Saginaw, Detroit, come embody light.
The voice of Jawan Choi. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan Family and the Sinaitic Fund. Mike Turpin is our engineer. I'm Grace Cavalieri.